Welcome to episode 273 of the Women of the Military podcast. This week, my guest is Laura Hatcher. April is the month of the military child, and because of that, I wanted to do an episode with a woman veteran who is also a military child. And I met Laura last year at the Women Veteran Alliance Unconference, and I heard a little bit of her story, and she talked about her childhood as a military brat. And I thought she would be the perfect guest to highlight her story as both a military officer in the Navy and also a military child. And I really loved how this episode came together. We got to talk about her time as a military child and some of the challenges she faced. And then we also got to hear her story as an officer in the military and a little bit about her transition from serving in the Navy to becoming an entrepreneur. And so I really hope you enjoy this episode. But before we get started, I want to remind you, you can listen to Women of the Military podcast on Reese Across America Radio on Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern and Saturdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. And you can listen on iHeartRadio, the TuneIn app, or Odyssey. And now with that out of the way, let's get started with this week's interview. Welcome, everyone, to Women of the Military podcast. I'm really excited to have Laura here. We met at the Women Veteran Alliance Unconference, and I wanted to reach out to have Laura on the podcast because I think April is a cool month to celebrate military kids. As a mom of military kids, I think that military kids have such a unique life experience that we need to talk about some of the challenges they have, especially my 10-year-old. I have PTSD. We move around a lot, and we moved to California. His teacher went to the same school that she's teaching at, like the same school district, and she's never moved. And so then when my then 9-year-old was like moving from Virginia to California, and they were, I don't understand why he's having so much trouble. I'm like, you never moved. So I just really think that military kids have to deal with so many grown-up emotions that sometimes even grown-ups don't even have to deal with. And so I want to highlight that. And so that's why I wanted to have you on the podcast.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
So normally we start with why did you decide to join the military, but we're going to go back farther because we're going to talk about your childhood a little bit. So can you talk a little bit about what it was like to be they call you military brat?
Military brat. And it's a term of affection, right? Term of endearment. Military brat. So I was actually born into the Air Force. We just don't talk about that. My biological father was a tech sergeant in the Air Force, but my parents divorced when I was 2. And so my mother raised me until I was 9 on her own. And then when she remarried a Navy sailor. So technically, I became a military brat probably around 9, because that's when I physically started moving as a result of that PCS acronym, the permanent change of station, for those people who aren't familiar with our acronyms. And it was a rude awakening, because if you can imagine, now I'm 9 years old, I've been with my mother alone for basically most of my life, and now I'm sharing her with a new adult figure. And we're moving from London, England, with the city, the bustle, the double-deck buses, my British accent, to Rota, Spain, which is a small fishing village with cobblestones, no double-decker buses, no city to speak of anywhere nearby anyway, fishing village, basically, southern tip of Spain. And it was a traumatic move for everybody. I think my stepfather probably got the short end of the stick on this one, just because, you know, when you're 9 as a young girl, as you probably know, you're developing, all right? You've got opinions. And I went to a DOD school, Dodd School. I know they still have them, but they're not as prevalent as they were. And that was challenging. That was definitely challenging because we quickly realized that the British system was vastly different from the American education system. And the things that they focused on in your primary years in England were more literature and reading and the arts and music. So I had impeccable calligraphy, you know, writing skills. I could play the violin, read music, but I was horrible at math. And it turned out I was about 2 grades behind. And that was my introduction to 3rd and 4th grade. The summer, we got there towards the tail end of 3rd grade. So the summer between 3rd and 4th grade at DGF? I think it's Farragut. Yeah, David Farragut School. And it was, you know, elementary all the way up through high school. I basically spent that entire summer learning long division, long subtraction, like memorizing my multiplication tables. So that was my introduction to the American system. And I was like pissed off the entire time, right? Because I'm spending summers in Spain doing math. It didn't hurt me, obviously, because I ended up, you know, doing well in high school, but it was definitely a challenging transition. And then learning, and I learned a new term from my own military brats. I have three sons. My eldest son taught me a term, third kid culture. It's very much related to military brats, but third kid culture, or third culture kid, excuse me, means that there's three cultures that are being introduced. So the culture that you're from, basically, and then the culture that you move to, and then the culture that's created as a result of being in those two spaces. So, and I didn't realize that at the time, but we essentially had to, you know, develop our own culture coming from England, living in Spain, American father, British mother. Yeah, it was challenging.
I mean, especially because you didn't, like, it wasn't your norm. And then all of a sudden your life drastically changed and you moved from one foreign country to another foreign, but then learning American school system. So it's like, all, I feel like you encapsulated like how hard it is to be a military kid. And like, I mean, that's what I was talking about. Like when we moved across country and they were like, he's just, because the system in Virginia, and it was the pandemic, it was very different than in California. And so that was just challenging. And then making friends in fourth grade, my first grader had a lot easier time making friends because he was a first grader. And so it was just like all these dynamics, and then like the emotions of like moving across the country and having to say bye to friends. And it was just, it's just really interesting because I feel so not supported and understood as a parent of a military child. And I'm sure he feels like similar, like he's, because they don't even really know what to do, to like what to say.
And the school system that inherited him wasn't like my school system, a DOD school, which at least the teachers themselves, you know, were used to seeing kids coming and going. But yeah, that's definitely hard. And it's the making friends part. That's the part that I think is probably the most challenging. And it's like the grass is greener, right? When you meet someone who, like you mentioned, the teacher, you know, going to that same school when they were a kid. So you meet someone that's grown up in the same town, same friend. You're almost, you know, jealous or envious of the fact that that happens. But really, at the end of the day, that diversity of moving around and being forced to interact with new people and new friends and new culture, that actually is a benefit. You don't see it as a kid. And now my advice to young people is don't try so hard to fit in, right? It's okay to be different. And I'm sure your kids can relate to this, but when someone asks, where are you from? Anxiety always kind of starts off first, like, all right, well, which version? Do you want the short version or do you want the long version?
I know, I hate going to conferences and they're like, where are you from? I'm like, well, I live in Virginia, but I'm from here. And I just don't know what to say to you because you think I'm crazy.
Yeah, but you know what? Embrace it. It's okay to say, you know, I can tell you all the places that I'm not from, all the places I moved. But yeah, I've lived in Alexandria, Virginia longer than I've probably lived anywhere now. So technically, I guess I'm from here. But yeah, that's challenging because everybody's definition of where you're from is so different.
And so many people know the answer to the question that it's really like awkward. At least I feel like everyone, like that's what everyone asked me at the conference. And I'm like, I don't know where I'm from because I had like just moved. This was a couple years ago. And I was like,
right,
I live in Virginia, but I'm not from there.
Well, I immediately respond with, oh, I was a military brat. And then it's like, oh, okay. And then if they want more, they're like, well, how was that? Or if it's like, okay, I understand. Don't take 10 minutes to explain it.
Is there anything else from your time as a military child that you think is really unique or different that you want to share before we dive into your military time?
Well, I do want to share, and I mentioned this when we met at a conference. We were talking about some family stuff. And one of the things that was hard, as I mentioned, in that transition from the British system to the American system was my mother had no clue that the American system gave children 3 months vacation during holiday, you know, during the summer. And she was, to use her vernacular, appalled. You're going to forget. I remember her telling me, I'm 9 years old. And she says, you're going to forget how to write your name. You're going to forget how to read. That we can't have that. You have to keep a journal. And I'm like, you know, can you imagine 9 year old going, what? I have to keep a journal? I have to do homework? And they said I have 3 months off? No. So I was actually very thankful. And I mentioned this when I met you. Thankful that she made me do it. I only did it for 1 year, but this is a copy of my journal from when I was 11 years old, stationed in Rota, Spain. And why I'm thankful is because when I go in and look at the days, and it's just so many amazing memories of what life on a base was all about, right? The highlight of your weekend was either going to the movies, going to the bowling alley, right? Or going to the swimming pool. So I spent an inordinate amount of time swimming. So I've got these pictures of me diving off the diving board or swimming in the lanes, and then people hanging out with me on the side. And there's probably pages and pages of, you know, an entire summer. And then, of course, you know, the fine cuisine on the base is always McDonald's.
Especially in Rota, Spain, right?
Especially in Rota, Spain, or whoever had the contract, right? You know, that was way before Subway. Yeah, it was some kind of sandwich, you know, contract or McDonald's. But, you know, I was not a proponent for this when she proposed it, obviously. But now looking back, I'm like, wow, this is an example of resilience, right? That you learn. And on top of that, when we were stationed in Rota, my biological father, who was in the Air Force at the time, still was stationed in Madrid. So at 9 and 10 years old, they're putting me on a plane by myself from Rota to the capital. I mean, what are the chances, right? That two, you know, a divorced family and the other parent's going to be in the same country, but they would send me up there for my holidays for the summers to visit him. Yet another base, more bowling alleys, more swimming pools. So definitely a similar culture, but obviously from a naval base to an Air Force base. But just truly thankful for that memory and the fact that she made me do that. And I even tried it with my kids, but it didn't fly at all.
They were like, no.
No. And they even called me out on it. Mom, you know you hated that. I'm like, I know.
You're like, but I love it now. You'll be the same way.
That's what social media is for, Mom.
That's true. I feel like sometimes social media means we like lost, you know, like when I was deployed, my husband and I wrote letters, and now people can just FaceTime or text and you don't have those letters. And I still have those letters saved, and they're kind of a piece of history. And you don't have phone calls and text messages saved. So I think it's great that technology changes, but then we also lose some things, and it's kind of sad.
Yeah. It's definitely different how we're keeping track of history, right? It's almost like we're curating our own history, whether or not we're deleting the pictures we don't want you to see or don't meet some kind of standard. Or like you said, you don't have the text messages, you know, anymore. Or if you do, maybe they're out of context and you don't remember what what it all is. So, but yeah, it's technology has definitely changed how we storytell as well as how we keep history.
So you decided to attend the Naval Academy. So what was that process like of, you know, graduating high school and then attending the Naval Academy?
Yeah, so I was in another DoD school at the time when I decided I was going to attend the Naval Academy. I was in the Republic of Panama, stationed with my stepfather, who's when we lived in Rota, Spain, he was an E6. And so now he's an E8. He was the command senior chief in Cocosolo, Republic of Panama, which is on the Atlantic side of the Isthmus, Panama. And he decided to introduce me to a young Marine who had recently graduated from the academy. So I was 15 at this point. So dating myself, but 1985. So if you think about that in terms of history, the first women graduating from the Naval Academy was in 1980. So he's now just introduced me to somebody who probably either was among that group of women or either just before or just after, right? So, and he wasn't sure in terms of colleges, but he had this young man in his in his unit, and he said, you know, would you talk to my daughter about the Naval Academy? So he introduces me. And the young Marine is really excited and enthusiastic about the whole process. And he brings out all these yearbooks that we're required to buy. I now have them too. And he's going through the whole thing. He's getting me pumped up. And I'm a student athlete. I'm a complete geek, but I'm really into sports at this point in my high school years. And at the end of it, for whatever reason, he just made this offhanded comment that says, yeah, it's a great place, but you probably wouldn't make it because you're just a girl. I was infuriated, stormed out of there, went back to my dad. I'm like, why did you introduce me to him? I'll show him. Where is that paperwork? This is back in the day where nothing's online, right? You have to fill everything out, those little bubble sheets. So I applied to the Naval Academy from there, and it all got lost in the mail, which is another side effect of being a military brat, right? Everything's by mail. Things get lost all the time. You end up starting things over, especially when you're transitioning from one school to the other. They're not talking to each other. Everything gets lost. And so I end up reapplying once we PCS. We end up PCSing prematurely from Panama because that was the same era as that guy that threw that little tantrum and they had a little war. So General Noriega. Yes. So when that happened, they evacuated all of the non-essentials or family members, which is, as we know, always never a dull moment when you're a military family, because you're always subject to whatever's going on politically in that country. And that was a very volatile time in Panama when I was living there. They would have anti-American demonstrations every Friday, but at least we knew what day it was, so we could. Let's avoid going out on that day. So my mom and I PCS'd ahead of him to San Diego, and I reapplied. Did not get in directly. I ended up going to the Naval Academy Preparatory School, and I was a volleyball player, and that technically say you they recruited me because we don't recruit at the Naval Academy. But they recruited me, and that's where they stashed me for a year, because in all of that historical time of being a military child, moving constantly to multiple schools, right? You know, your academic record, it's just eclectic, right? The standards aren't the same. You've gone to multiple schools in multiple different countries. Nothing really translates. And I was a horrible test taker. So I bragged that I had the lowest SAT scores in the state of California. I'm probably the reason why they got rid of them. And so I got invited to go to the prep school as a result of my SAT scores just not being up to snuff in terms of getting in directly. And that's okay, because, you know, we all make it our own way, you know, and the 5-year, 4-year program was just as successful for me as the 4-year program. And then that's how I got in. And, you know, if you pass prep school up in Newport, Rhode Island, and Naval Academy has their own, which is where it's located in Newport, but there are also foundation schools around the United States that feed into all the service academies. But if you successfully make it through the prep school, then you get invited to start over.
Start again as a freshman.
Start again.
I mean, I've interviewed people, and I know people who went through the prep school at, you know, the Air Force Academy. I don't think I know anyone at the Army, but I probably do. But it's not like, it's just a way to get into the school, and it's really challenging to get in, especially if you're not a good test taker or if you don't meet like one of the boxes. So I think it's great. And just, I was looking you up on LinkedIn and I saw some of the highlights from your career, and you had a successful career, and it doesn't really matter. Oh yeah. And when I saw the dates, I was like, oh, 1987, because that's when you went to the academy, right? And I was thinking like Gulf War, September 11th, but I forgot about like how quickly after it was from when women, I'm working on a episode for March for Women History Month, which I guess will have already gone live, that I'll link to, about women between 1970 and 1990, because so much rich history happened for women. Like the WAC was dissolved, women were allowed to go to the academies, the first women pilots who were like actually not, the WASP served during World War II. I know about them, but like actually were given, you know, the rank of service member and all the different, there was like so much stuff that happened for women in that time period that often is like forgotten about in history books. It's because there wasn't like a war. Vietnam ended and then Gulf War happened, but all this stuff happened for women.
Yeah, I stood on those shoulders, those giants, you know, that paved the way. So super thankful for that. I really, you're right. I'm glad that the Women's War Memorial, which I know you're fully aware of, is documenting that history because it's really important. There will be a point where there'll be a generation of people that are like, okay, who cares? So what? Because they don't understand how hard it was to get to where we are. But until that point, I think it's awesome that we're spending more time focusing on those stories because there are some amazing women that did some amazing things that we still haven't heard about.
For sure. I mean, I've learned so much from doing the podcast, and it's just remarkable to hear about like everything that was going on. And then if you like just deep dive into women's history, there's like so many things that were happening and changing, and it's what led to women being able to in 2015 to serve in any job in the military. And like it, I think it started, you know, way back throughout the whole history, but there was a whole bunch of advocacy work done in the 70s and 80s that made a huge difference for women in the military. So let's talk a little bit about your time at the academy. What was that like? Besides that, you, I feel like you were like, I'm not quitting no matter what.
Yeah, you know, we always joke that it's a great place to be from, not necessarily be at. Yeah, if you think about it, it's not meant to be fun. We even have shirts that say not college, you know, with the N star, right? Not college. It's not college. It's, you know, it's a leadership incubator. It's a place to learn about your morals and your integrity and your leadership style. And obviously there's a very rigorous academic. I don't think I would have done it any differently. I came from a very strict household. You know, that stepfather I mentioned, the Navy sailor, he was also Puerto Rican. So Hispanic culture, very, very strict upbringing. I didn't have a curfew because you're not going out. So what do you need a curfew for? You're not allowed to have boyfriends. So what are we discussing exactly, Laura? You know, and white glove, I'm not exaggerating, white glove inspections, you know, chores. I was raised with, you know, so I joke, but I'm actually telling the truth. I felt like the Naval Academy was easier than being at home, you know, so I was used to that kind of institutionalized, you know, consistent, you know what to expect, when to eat, what to wear, all that stuff. Having grown up in the military, and I think a lot of military kids probably have a little bit of that. Right, because your parents are always on display, right? Especially if they're in some kind of command position. People would talk about me to my dad all the time. Your daughter was seen walking across the courtyard yesterday, you know, and he'd tell me, and I'm like, why is that news? Well, who are you walking with? Oh, okay, that part might be important. You know, so you're in a fishbowl, to bring it back to that military brat thing. You're always in a fishbowl. If your parent is in any kind of leadership position, you know, then the fishbowl is even smaller.
Yeah, we haven't ever lived on base, but I mean, I could definitely see that, especially if you live on base and if your parent is like a high leadership and they know who the kid is, and then they're like, oh, I saw. Yeah.
Yeah. So my time at the academy was fine. I mean, I, as a varsity athlete, felt like it was a little bit harder because I had a sense of loyalty to stay on the team, you know, and support that team because that's how I got in. But, you know, you also have to keep your academics up, and you're traveling, you know, all the time. But, you know, you make some lifelong friends, obviously get a great academic foundation. And you don't realize it when you're there, and you probably don't even realize it when you're serving. I'm seeing the fruits of that whole labor now, is that network, the Alumni Association, so strong, so many events, so much camaraderie. I mean, when you meet somebody who's from the academy, it's almost I would imagine it's like that with any school that has a strong alumni foundation. But there, in my small business that I run now, I keep track of where I get my leads from, and a lot of the times it's either a classmate or it's another class or an alum from the Naval Academy that contributes to my success as a businesswoman. So much like the veteran community in general, right? The veteran community is like a fraternity.
It is. And then it's just that much stronger the more like commonality. I think that's why like women veteran conferences are so great because you have that connection. And just like, if you go to the academy, then that's going to be very different than like, I did ROTC, which is actually fun. It's not college, it is college.
College.
And so that just makes life a little bit different. And the more commonalities you have, the stronger the connection is. And I think military service like bonds you together. I've met veterans that I like don't I did this experiment thing where you talked with random people and then we both figured out we were veterans, and they were trying to film us like get to know each other, and we wouldn't stop talking because we were like, oh, what unit did you serve in? And he and I had like this best conversation. Once we figured out we were veterans, it was like they couldn't get us to stop. And so and we had like nothing else in common, but military service tied us together, and it was really cool.
It is very cool. Yeah, when you make that connection, it's almost like an instant credibility, right? And sure enough, in my case, there's always 6 degrees to somebody. I may not know you, but I know your boss or his boss, and it doesn't matter what service. And my kids even say, "God, Mom, we can't go anywhere without anybody knowing you." I'm like, "I don't know." I'm like, "I don't know what you're talking about." He goes, "Doesn't matter where we are in the world, you know everybody." I was like, "I don't really know everybody. I just know everybody who knows everybody."
It's just a small world when you're connected with so many people through the military. I feel like we've been talking for 28 minutes and we were like, and you went to the academy. So let's talk a little bit about your career as well. So what job did you end up doing, and where was your first assignment?
So when I left the Naval Academy, we service select, and I chose to be a Navy diver. But they lied. There's hardly any diving in Navy diving, so that didn't last very long. I caught on about after my first tour, but I wanted to be in a physically challenging community, and that's that athlete, right, that was recruited originally. I also wanted to stand next to my male peer, and I wanted him to know that I had done exactly the same requirements that he did. And that way, there's no question. The general military physical requirements, there's a woman's scale and a men's scale. But in the specialized communities, for various reasons, in this case, a diving rig is very heavy. And so we had to have more upper body strength than most communities. And so I worked very hard to be in shape and be able to maintain and do the same entry requirements as my male counterpart. But as an officer, you tend to do more. This is any service, more leadership roles than the doing roles, the fun stuff. So I did not get to dive as much. And my first sea tour was just that. It was a sea tour on a diving and salvage vessel. And so once I was done with that, I was just a little disappointed with my first tour, let's just say. I'll keep the PG version, and wanted to quit. And it was my stepfather that said, "Oh, no. You've invested way too much time. You need to figure out these other communities and other opportunities that you can switch into before you decide to quit." Because at that point, when you've done your first tour, if you think about it, the average person at O3 is about 8 years, 9 years. For academy person, add the 5 years onto that, you really invested a lot of time. And it's common for JOs to get to that 10-year mark and go, "Oh, do I, especially if you only owed five for the original contract, it's common to go, "Okay, I think maybe this is a crossroads. Maybe I want to get out." But he's like, "No, you can't leave on a bad note. You can't leave with a bad taste in your mouth." So I switched over to intelligence. He was a cryptologist, so signals, and he introduced me kind of to those two communities and said, "Put your request in. Only a very fine number, a small number of people get picked up. You have to be successful from the community you're coming into." But I was picked up on my first look, and then there's the rest is history. I basically did multiple intelligence tours in Japan, Hawaii, Norfolk area. And I'm summarizing so we don't spend 26 minutes on Navy diving. But yeah, and naval intelligence was great because you were doing something different. Every single tour was different. Became a jack of all trades. And so I got a lot of amazing skill sets, soft skills and hard skills out of that. A lot of leadership opportunities for some of the things I did. So I enjoyed it. It's very eclectic and you never get bored because you're always doing something different. And the beauty of it is when people ask you, well, what do you do? And you say, oh, I was an intelligence officer. And then I look at them, I go, okay, so we're done talking.
You're like, and I can't tell you anything else. So I hope you enjoyed that part.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so when you switched career fields, was that before or after September 11th?
That was in 1996.
Okay, so right before. So how did the intelligence, or did the intelligence community on a general whole change very much between before September 11th and after? Because I know with deployments and well, actually the Navy seems to always be going, they don't have a low ops tempo. So was there any change that you noticed?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I changed my designator within intelligence as well once I got in to manage reserves. So you're Air Force, so you'd be familiar with the term AGR. So we had an AGR community. We called it TARS, Training and Administration of Reserves. And then shortly after that, my dad would say, you know what that spells backwards, right? I'm like, yeah, okay, Dad. And then they changed the term, the acronym to FTS, Full-Time Support. But I switched from active duty intelligence into AGR. So became a reservist, a full-time reservist, so I could manage reserves. And we don't do IMAs like the Air Force does, we do units. And that was right before 9/11. And I will tell you the burden, the predominance of all the deployments that I saw were on the reserve side. The reserve intelligence really stepped up and deployed all the time because I was the one calling and tapping them on the shoulder saying, time for you to go, and making sure I was their advocate. I was doing all their administrative. That was the purpose of my job, and my small, amazing staff that I had is making sure that they were ready, both physically as well as administratively, whereas pay, we were constantly keeping track of, where they were in that deployment continuum, making sure that when they deployed, that the timelines made sense, because sometimes you'd have these ludicrous requirements where someone who lived in New York had to travel all the way to Florida, for example, to process. I'm like, okay, what about the processing station that's right there in New Jersey? Do you think we could use some common sense and perhaps, give them more time with the family before we put them out instead of making them go, all the way? Those are the kind of things that we do. Or someone with a pay problem, that would take you and I, on active duty, would take you 5 minutes to resolve, or maybe even a day or so. On the reserve side, it could take months, sometimes years, And so I really, truly loved those roles where I was able to be the reserve advocate because I could speak both languages, having come from the active duty side. Because when you start talking to an active duty person about the reserves, their eyes start to roll back, right? They don't understand all the acronyms, ADT, ADSW, all that stuff. All they will care about is when do I get my butt in seats, right? When can I start working on my project?
And I think if you don't know a lot about what the National Guard and Reserve does, you don't realize what a commitment it is. I think even when people sign up, they don't realize what the commitment is because I deployed with the National Guard, the Army National Guard, when I deployed. And I think all the infantry units that were with, because I was on a provincial reconstruction team and there were 13 teams. And I feel like all the units that were supporting us were National Guard. There was a handful of active duty people sprinkled in, but really it was the National Guard that was supporting the mission that we were doing. And it was a huge mission in Afghanistan. And so, and that was just one thing that was going on. And so, and I know that, the Navy doesn't have a National Guard. So the reserve in the Air Force and the Army stepped up as well in different ways. But I think people just don't realize how much sacrifice people who were serving part time, but then often were paying,
No clue. And that's why I enjoyed my job, because what I try to explain to active duty people who are transferring into the reserves, as well as just, the rest of the world, they're basically got three roles, right? They've got their civilian role. And some of these reservists are you know, incredibly important in whatever industry they're in, CEOs of you name what, you know, senators or whatever, or they're the owner of their mom and pop, you know, historical family business, you know, and leaving, the whole thing could collapse kind of thing. But they're also doing their reserve role. And then they're also managing their families too. And the piece that people never really realize is readiness on the reserve side was so much more important, especially medical readiness, than on the active duty side. If I did not get my flu shot or blew it off for a couple of years, nobody was beating down my door and telling me that they were about to admin set me, right? I was not getting notifications saying that we're kicking you out of the Navy because you forgot to take your flu shot. But oh my goodness, on the reserve side, if I had sailors who had missed their flu shot or vaccinations or whatever, you know, I would have a reserve center calling me saying, hey, we're about to process your sailor who has a $90,000 TSSCI clearance out because he didn't get his flu shot. And I'm like, oh, slow down, sailor. Slow down. <All right. laughs> Let me insert myself into this process. You know, I call up my sailor and say, hey, go to CVS right now and fax me the paperwork. But it takes that common sense and that advocacy to step in and make sure. And, you know, when you tell an active duty person that, oh, he didn't do his training and therefore he can't come and work for you because the orders got denied because he didn't do his, you know, the CBT on the annual training. You have to stress about there's only so many ways that you can measure effectiveness and readiness on the reserve side. And it's those things like the things that we don't necessarily take, that we take for granted, you know?
Yeah, because it's our day-to-day job and we have to get it done. And it's just kind of part of our, you know, our daily rhythm or even our yearly rhythm. And it's very different when it's not your full-time thing and you're just trying to get everything done you need to get done. And a few things slide. Does that make sense?
It does. And it's amazing how much they get done on one weekend too. I would go visit my units and they're like, ma'am, we're going to give you a tour. I'm going to give you a presentation, but just please know that we're doing our PRT at 2 and then we're doing the urinalysis for the month at 4. And, you know, and it's all crammed in to one weekend. You're like, do it. Do whatever you got to get done.
I know, because they have so much they have to do. And yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, and it also is kind of interesting because when I was considering if I should stay in or get out and do the reserve thing, and people are like, oh, just join the reserve. And like, they don't even like think about what the commitment is. And they're just like, just do that. And I'm like, okay. And I ended up not doing that. But I'm glad that I didn't because I've learned so much more about it. And especially my career field, civil engineering, we were deploying a lot. And I was still deployed in the Guard and Reserve. So no one really talked about they're just go part time. I was like, I love that you talk about like taking care of people. It's in your DNA. You found your thing you love.
Definitely. That I would say the reserve management jobs that I have were highlights. I mean, other people will probably point to some of the other things I've done, which they're cool pictures. I don't know if you found it buried at the bottom of my LinkedIn profile, but there's a picture of George H.W. Bush, 41, kissing me on the cheek. I got voluntold to be the commissioning coordinator for the carrier that was named after him while he was still alive. So that was kind of a highlight. One, because I wasn't expected to be kissed in front of the entire crew of 3,000 people in a party. And two, they surprised me with a spot award, and me and my assistant. And so we're up on the stage and, you know, he signed an award for running it's basically like running the biggest wedding party you could imagine with every single head of state present. And because, you know, his son was in office at the time. And so, and he brought everybody with him. And so that it was kind of nerve wracking. So the award was a 1-day award, a bit of a surprise. And when he kisses me on the cheek, my assistant leans over quietly and on the stage and looks at me and goes, sir, you're not going to kiss me in front of everybody, are you? And he goes, no, I'm not. It was funny, but that was very cool. Just an amazing event to see. If you've ever seen a commissioning of a ship or the ship coming alive with the first crew. So being part of, we call it plank owner, being a plank owner of a carrier is definitely a highlight. And then, of course, obviously taking care of people, making sure everybody got their plank owner certificates. That was part of my job. 3,000 certificates. But no, that was great. And then just being part of that history, you know, because he didn't pass away right after that. He definitely had so much energy and enthusiasm about his own ship. You know, he'd come down and visit while we were still in the yards. And that was just neat to see that part of history unfold. So definitely a highlight. I guess I'm supposed to say another highlight would be when I was in command. But to be honest, that was very stressful. And when it was over, it was like, I can go back to drinking and being the most senior person in the room, you know, because you're constantly worrying about people because it was a deployable command, right? But no, I had a great career.
I got to interview someone who she was enlisted, and she talked about like bringing everything onto the ship. And she's like, there was nothing. And then all the work that they had to do to like make it a functional ship. And then like their first tour, getting everything certified. And it was a really cool interview. I can't remember off the top of my head what number it was, but she talked about being a plank owner and like all the tradition and the ceremony. And it was just eye-opening because it's like, obviously someone has to put all the stuff on the ship, but like, you don't think about it. It's just there, right? And it's like, no, we had to put the forks and the knives, like everything that needs to be on, even the smallest detail of like what needs to be there.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, that's with anything, right? The house that you're sitting in used to be a patch of ground. We had to build it. The same thing with ships. Yeah, that's and a ship that is a floating city. I mean, can you imagine how many forks they brought on?
I know, I was just mind blown. And it's like, obviously, duh, like you have to bring all that stuff. But I just had never thought about like how that came to be and that people had that as their job. And so, yeah, her job was something totally different. But while they were getting the ship ready, it was to bring crates and crates of stuff and unpack everything. And
so when our ships are not commissioned yet, they're called PCUs, pre-commissioning unit. And you have a pre-commissioning crew, and their sole job is to help complete the build out. And then some of them, you know, will overlap into maybe the first deployment. I left before the first deployment, but I did get to make sure that the foundation for all of the intelligence spaces on that carrier were, you know, built to specification and that they were skiffed correctly. Whether or not they worked later, not my fault, but I made sure, you know, that the things that had to be made in place first for them to eventually be certified were there, you know. It's a team effort, whether you meet the team or not, because that team goes on for, you know, really forever, if you think about it, because continuous evolution, you know, of usage for the life of that ship. So I was the first. So I guess it would be my fault if nothing worked at the end, right?
I'm sure it all worked. They didn't come find you, so it must have been fine.
It's too late. I threw away all the notes. It's funny she said it didn't come find me. I did get phone calls and emails for about 4 or 5 years because I ran the commissioning.
Oh,
and
so, wow.
Yes. I did. And I, after a while, I was like, yeah, just trying to make a plan and then expect the Secret Service to just blow it apart. That's all I remember.
You're like, I don't know. That was years ago. Let's move on.
I did. I do remember getting phone calls about that. Yeah, it's like, how did you make it all work together? I'm like, I didn't. It was like herding butterflies.
Well, then it sounds like it was a success if they were asking for your advice. So you decided to leave the military, and I think it's interesting that you were doing intel and like all, not that your work now isn't important, but being a photographer is very different than that sort of background. And I'm sure you had like your clearance. You could have done anything. What led you on the path that you're on today?
Yeah. So I retired in 2018. I always say I took my clearances and ran in the opposite direction from all of the three-letter agencies that are in my neighborhood. And there's plenty of them. I got plenty of invitations to go back. But, you know, it took me a hot minute to realize, oh, wow, this is the first time you get to make a decision to go see, to do whatever you want, and not just from a list of things that they need you to do, right? Because needs of the Navy Yeah, the detailer or the monitor, depending on your service, says, okay, we've got these things, choose something. But you always have to choose something that you don't think is going to be a career ender, or, you know, the schools are good for your kids, or the work hours are good for conducive to your, you know, work-life balance, all that stuff. All that aside, now it's like you can do anything you want to. It's actually daunting. It's actually overwhelming. And I didn't do a very good job the first year I got out because I felt like I had to go back immediately and have a full-time job. In fact, I was already employed before I was even off of terminal leave because that's the way we're wired, right? Been employed my entire life. Why would I take a break? I went and worked for a nonprofit my first year out, and it was good in the sense that I could take all the skill sets, the soft skills that I had from the Navy, and use it to support this nonprofit because they were looking for someone who really understood DoD. So they could partner with that industry. Culturally, we didn't mesh. And that's one thing that I'm sure many of your guests have told you, how hard it is to transition from the military into the civilian world, especially if you stay as long as I did, you know, so 31 years in the actual uniform, and then whatever the math is before that with my dad, right? So I've been ingrained in the military mindset my entire childhood and adult life. And there's a certain way of thinking and eating and, you know, breathing. And if you're not around people who are also in that culture, it's very challenging to fit in or even come across as someone who isn't intimidating. I'm sure to the civilian world, I must be, before I even open my mouth, I'm probably pretty intimidating, especially if you look at my photos in uniform or what I've done. But I just wanted to go in and be a worker bee. You know, I'm here. I want to play. But even just showing up 10 minutes early can be intimidating, right? Because early is on time. It's not even 9 o'clock yet. What are you doing here? It's 8:50. What do you mean? What am I doing here? The littlest things that we are hold to, you know, in terms of our standards in the military do not translate directly on the civilian side. Anyway, once I tried my hand at being in the civilian world, I didn't enjoy it. And I also didn't enjoy the process of finding a job, having to write the resume, you know, and there's plenty of resources out there, as you know, for people to help you translate what you did in the military. But at the end of the day, if you've been doing that your whole life, why would you necessarily want to go back to doing that? I would attest it's because it's safe, right? I could have easily gone and been an intelligence officer as a civilian, but now I have an opportunity to go do something else. And I also would prefer to have some more flexibility. I really missed, you know, the whole era of raising my children, right? My husband got to do more of that total role reversal, being the active duty mother that I was. And now they're at the tail end when I retired of high school and in college. And so wouldn't it be nice to maybe not catch up, right? Can't make up for that lost time already, but it would be nice to be part of their adult life now so that I'm not completely absent in their minds as a parent. And so I, working for myself affords that. And then fast forward, you know, 5, 6 years later, when your parents start to get older, you know, now you become a caretaker for them or their needs. And so that's essentially where I am now, you know, and I have that flexibility as much as it's been challenging to learn how to be a business owner and generate enough revenue. At the end of the day, I still have a pension. I still have healthcare. So that's one of the drivers behind why I thought being a business owner would work, right? As long as, of course, I did opt to stay in a very high cost of living area, which is not recommended. But like most people who get out, though, the dilemma of where do you want to live? I can give you a long list of where I don't want to live. But we end up staying here in this area because my children, you know, that when given the choice, didn't want to move anymore. So,
I mean, there's so many things about being a business owner that are good. It's not easy, but it is something that gives you that flexibility. You have control over your schedule. And then I was thinking about like so many people that are like around my age or older are in that, like raising kids and also, you know, caretaking parents. I hear more and more of my friends talking about like that, you know, being sandwiched between both of those situations. And I think it's really hard to like be in that situation. And I don't think there's enough talk about like how hard it is and like even mentally, but also like it's financially draining. I've had so many conversations with friends who are like, we don't know what we're going to do because, you know, it is so expensive to get help. And then like, and if you're taking care of your kids and your family, like how are you also going to take care of an adult? And so there's a lot of dynamics to that, but having a business and being able to, you know, work your schedule around, you know, your life is a great thing. And having, you know, the pension and the medical, it makes it even easier to do those things because you have a little bit of support.
It takes the pressure off a little bit. I wouldn't say it makes the job easier because the business, there's a lot of things about business that you don't realize until you get into it. And then suddenly you're like, I'm not really doing much photography. I'm actually doing a hell of a lot of other things. I'm an amazing accountant now. I'm a great customer service person. I can do just about everything other than get to push the button as much as I want. But what I was going to say is I would encourage those listeners that are thinking about it, especially if you're a veteran, encourage you to remember that we have been taught so many things that I personally am using as a business owner. You don't even realize that the training that you've had, regardless of what your rank was, whether you were enlisted or officer, we all were taught certain things that translate directly into being entrepreneurs. Whether you're under a franchise, which tends to appeal to a lot of veterans because franchises are like having a chain of command, you know, with they set guidance and then you run your own little command, you know, as long as you're making money, you seem to be doing well. Solopreneurs, not so much guidance, it's home alone. But I have to remind myself, I have to pause and go, you know what? I've been in this situation before when my sailor X did sailor Y, you know, did this or did that. Whatever the scenario is, I have to just dig deep and go, okay, I've been here. Let me apply that training that I had as an XO or CO to this situation. So,
well, we're almost going to run out of time. So I want to end it with, what advice would you give to a young woman who's considering joining the military?
So I had such an amazing time, but I would make sure to tell them to do it for themselves. And not from any type of influence from family, or, you know, if you have a history of veterans in your family or your friends, but truly research what you're getting into, find resources, other veterans in whatever service you're looking at, to really give you some detailed guidance. Because I think sometimes people jump in without realizing what they're getting into, and it's not for everybody, and it's okay to say, no, this is not for me, especially if it's your parents or your teachers or somebody else projecting, living vicariously through you. and I know this for a fact because I used to interview young men and women to go to the Naval Academy. I was a blue and gold officer, and I could easily tell if it was the parents' dream versus the kids' dream, you know, based off of how much they understood what they were getting into, whether or not they had visited and they lived half a mile down the street from the academy, or whether or not they even knew there were other academies. You know, you could tell when someone really, really wants something. They put energy into figuring out and researching. And so that's what I would offer, is make sure it's for you and not for anyone else that might be influencing your decision. So
I agree. I started A Girl's Guide to Military Service with deciding if the military is right for you and understanding your why, because I agree, you have to do it for yourself, and you have to, it's not for everyone. So if you, it's not for you, that's totally fine, but you need to go through those questions. So thanks so much for being a guest. I'm really glad we got to do this interview.
I appreciate it.